now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
Startups are the worst thing to do for money, because the probability of it succeeding is so low. So it's funny, you get all these people, the number one reason they do it is, oh, it's a great way. And look, there's so many easier ways to make money than doing a startup. So you better really enjoy it, because that might be all you're going to get out of a startup.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley. How's everyone doing? I'm your host, Danny Fortson, the West Coast correspondent for the Sunday Times. And this week, people, we're talking about charging, car charging, specifically why the current model, you know, superchargers, wall chargers, etc., not going to work. So a little story, which is not at all unique, but I think kind of helps illustrate the point. So recently we swapped out our 2006 Toyota Prius. I sold it for a very crazy price, just because given gas prices, suddenly everybody wants one, even if they're old, with fading paint, stained upholstery, very loved, let's say. I sent her off to another owner, and I'm sure that car will have many, many years left in it. Anyhow, our new car is a Tesla. It's a cool car, I'm not gonna lie. But the whole charging experience has been really interesting. So we got the charger installed at the house, so you plug it in overnight and presto, full charge, you're good, etc. However, we took it on our first road trip recently, and you know, the charging thing, it's not like popping into a gas station, you go fill up for 5 minutes and you're on your way. Charging is a thing. The car tells you where the superchargers are on the route, you pull over, you plug in the car, and then you go kick it somewhere. In our case, we went to a Starbucks nearby where our kids devoured copious amounts of banana bread, and we just hung out, waited for half an hour until it was charged. And that half hour is not a full charge. So we drove to my brother's place, which is in Santa Barbara, which is about 270 miles driving from where we live in Oakland. And by that time we got down there, we had to do another 25 minute charge while we were there, because we were driving around a little bit on the weekend, and then we had to do another charge on the way home. So keep in mind, this is again 270 miles. Now if we were in our trusty Honda, kind of, you know, the bigger car we use when we're doing these type of trips, usually it would have been like 10 minutes tops filling up time for the whole trip. This was at least, it was like a good 90 minutes. Now it was cheaper, and it was electric, that's cool. But it was definitely, you know, a thing, a very different thing. It's a kind of a pain point in the whole kind of EV experience. And I think it's one of the reasons why widespread adoption is kind of one of the big obstacles. And I bring this up because this week's guest has a completely different approach. His name is John D'Souza. And he's the co-founder and CEO of a company called Ample. And it's a startup that, rather than doing charging, just swaps out your battery. Takes out your spent battery and gives you a brand new one. And you can do that like once a week, once every 2 weeks, however long, however big your battery is and however much you drive. Maybe every other day, who knows? So it's created a business around this idea. You drive into one of their facilities, it just kind of looks like a kind of space age garage. You drive in there and then it kind of extracts the battery from underneath the car, inserts a new one, fully charged, boom, you're in and out, 10 minutes, bye-bye. Now, obviously, getting the big car makers to buy in to this kind of giant change in how they're making their cars is a big deal. So that's a big ask, because, you know, the battery is the most expensive part of the car. It's, you know, runs along the base of most models, and making it extractable and replaceable will be, you know, that's their challenge. They've figured out the tech. They now need to get the world to agree that this is what we should be doing. But what's interesting is that they're already doing this apparently at large scale in China, which is much further along in their use of EVs. And there is a ton of advantages he goes through as well. Anyhow, it's an interesting idea, and John is not somebody to bet against, I guess you would say, because he started and sold three companies before this one. He's raised $250 million for this idea. And he's already signed up a bunch of big partners, big car companies, to kind of bring this vision to life. So it's kind of one of these things that's, you know, I'd never heard of this company, came across them, and I was like, oh, whoa, they've raised this amount of money, and this guy has done all of these companies before, and they're having success. It's just kind of interesting. So brought John on. He's a super interesting guy. He was born in Ethiopia, grew up in Abu Dhabi, went to uni in America at age 16. So he's just this really unique background, I think, as well, that also really informs what he's done with his life and how he has dealt with, you know, some pretty big challenges that he keeps putting in front of himself. So we talk about that. We talk about the present and future of electric cars, his grand plan to kind of help accelerate this whole shift, and, you know, his personal story, which again is just very compelling and interesting. And then lastly, for the entrepreneurs out there, he has really great insights from his day as an investor. He was on the investing side for a while as well. And, you know, he shares some of the insights he learned about, you know, why investors say no to a company and why their reasons are almost always total lies. It's true. Anyhow, we cover all of that and more, and we're going to get to it right now. So here is my conversation with John D'Souza, founder of Ample. Enjoy. Well, thank you for being on the show. And I must say, given that you are calling from Madrid, I'm totally jealous. I mean, we have about the same weather right now, but as discussed before we started recording, it's one of the great cities in Europe, I think.
It is an incredible city. I've lived in a few different cities. What I like about it is one of the few cities where you get to know the locals. And yeah. My first experience here is I was actually watching my son's soccer game, and two families came over to me and said, "You can't be in Madrid and watch a game on your own." And they invited me to dinner. So I got to know these two families, and I'm still very good friends with them. But it's a rare city where people, they just bring you into the community. And if you ever need something, my son broke his arm. I needed help late at night, and people came to hospital. It was past midnight. They were there with us. So it's a really wonderful, the food is good, the weather is wonderful, but the people are incredible.
Amazing. Amazing. So we've covered a lot of EV stuff in the electric vehicle world. And I saw what you guys are up to, which is really interesting. And it reminded me, and you can tell me whether this is wrong, of, was it BYD, but, you know, Build Your Dream or whatever, the big Chinese company that has been talking about doing something similar for years and years, where you basically replace the battery as opposed to charge it. And I know there's been a lot, this concept is going around for, has been around for a long time, but if you could just describe kind of Ample, what it is you guys are doing, how long have you been at it, and if actually, you know, what the kind of, what traction you're getting there, because, you know, having just purchased an electric vehicle, which is super cool, never going to go back to petrol powered cars. And the charging thing, it's totally fine most of the time. It can be kind of a pain. You know, you have to kind of plan around it, but it's miles better than, of course, it was back in the day. But it does feel like it's still, that is still to be kind of, there's still room to kind of improve that experience, because, of course, everybody just compares it to, I can go to the gas station and in 5 minutes, I'm good to go, you know? So there's still ways to go.
You know, the interesting thing is, but the competition for electric is gas, and it works really well.
Yeah.
And the problem is that's the standard. It's a golden standard. People go, wait, I don't need to think about gas. I keep on saying that people don't have range anxiety. They have charging anxiety. Because what happens when you run out? Because when you run out of gas, you're not worried. You know, you just stop at a gas station and you move on. But it's the trauma you can have when it runs out. That, and you just need it once,
totally.
And that's going to stay for a long time. So it's not good enough. And I think you hit the keywords. It works well most of the time, not all the time. And you need something especially if you need your vehicle for your livelihood or to get things done, you need it to work all the time. It can't work 90% of the time because that's not good enough. So when we looked at this, it was 8 years ago when my partner, Halit Hassoun and I, we sat there and we were sitting there trying to look at the full transition to electric. And we kept on going back that the full charging thing just didn't make sense. It just was too broken. And we said, fast forward, are people working on things that is going to solve this problem 5-10 years from now? And we didn't see it. When we spoke to people at the time, they said, look, in 2 years, we'll have solid-state batteries. You'll be able to charge them in 2 to 5 minutes, and it'll work great. It just never sounded like that was going to happen.
Yeah.
Even if you could have a battery you charge in 2 minutes, you need a 1 megawatt charger. You're not going to put them everywhere. Just too many issues. So then we went back and said, the reason gas works so well is that you stop, you physically move the gas into your car and you drive away. You're not trying to create gas and do everything at the station.
Right.
And so we said, that's a great model. What if you just took your car there and physically move the batteries into it and drive away? It mimics gas. So in the way what we're doing is we're providing a gas station for electric cars where you drive in, you swap out your batteries and you go on. And now people have done this in the past, and there's actually an interesting video on YouTube where there was an electric taxi fleet in Spain in the 40s where they had battery swapping. In the 40s, a hand crank. Now you go, well, what happened to it? Well, gas was very efficient. And more importantly, what the beauty about gas is it can work in any car. So when you looked at previous attempts at swapping, there were a couple of things that made it not work that well. The first one is that it didn't work with any car. It was very specific to a maker, and that doesn't work. But the beauty of gas is it doesn't matter. It's agnostic. Anybody comes in and you can try it. So we wanted to create a method to do battery swapping that worked across different vehicles without asking the car manufacturer to change the car in any way. And that's what we do. So we do a type of swapping called modular battery swapping that gives you a full charge in a few minutes, and it works across different brands.
So say I have a Tesla and I find one of your ample swapping stations. You're going to remove my Tesla battery out of my car and put a different battery in.
So the way we work, we do it at the point at which you receive it. So when you go to buy your car, you would choose, do I want to swap a battery or do I want a fixed battery? You know, if the battery is something that you wanted, you know, and for Tesla, assume your battery costs $30,000. If you felt, look, I want to pay her $30,000. I want to own this battery and keep it for, it's yours. If you go with our model, you'd buy the car without the battery. So you buy the car less than a Tesla case, $30,000, but you buy it without that. And then you'd go in and you'd just do a small battery subscription to use the batteries. It also allows you the ability to choose how much battery you put in the car. A Tesla battery probably weighs 1,000 pounds. So you use probably 30% of the energy just moving that battery around.
Yeah.
And most of the time you don't need it. So if you could do a variable size battery, you could choose the right amount of battery so you're a lot more efficient. But if you're doing a long trip, put all the battery in and get the full range.
I see. And so does Tesla, does BMW, does Kia, all these companies that are coming out with electric models. I mean, I have never seen any of them, although I haven't looked for it. Do they give you the option of, like, you know, you can buy the car without the battery?
So currently we're focused on fleets. So if you're going through and you're deploying a fleet of vehicles, you can go in and choose that option and get it. Our strategy to get to consumers initially work with fleets in a city, get a deployment of stations across the full area, and then go to consumers. So I'd probably say it'd probably be a couple of years before we start selling directly to consumers.
Right. And have you talked to the kind of the big brands and kind of pitched this idea? I mean, and what is the response? Because as you say, you know, battery is the most expensive part of the car. It's the kind of the biggest part of the car. It's the kind of, I would presume it's this way for all electric vehicles, but it's basically the whole floor of the car, or most of it is just, you know, it's the kind of the scaffolding upon which everything else is built. It feels like that would be quite a big ask for them to be like, yeah, start selling these with an option where you don't have a battery.
The battery is also the biggest pain.
Yeah.
On multiple fronts, you know, right now, if you sell the car, you sell it with a big battery, not everybody needs it. You pay a lot for it. When the battery degrades, it brings down the full value of the car. The resale value is tied to the, So if you buy an electric car, the promise of electric cars, the maintenance costs will be 10%, and you can use it for 20 years and without a problem. But if your battery goes bad in a few years, you've just shot the value of your car. So it decreases it. Warranty on batteries are very expensive to recall and to go through and fix them. They're tied into it. And new technologies come out. So if you have new cells, you can't easily put them in old cars. So the big thing with swapping is it solves all those problems. That you can put newer chemistries in older cars. You know, a car 10 years will probably go twice as far as when you bought it, right, because you have newer cells in it. You can keep the car for as long as you want. And then you buy the car for a lot less because you're separating out the price of the battery. And recalls are very easy because the cars are swapping anyway. So if you need to recall batteries, the next time they swap, you take those batteries out and you don't put them in. So it solves a lot of the problem for the OEMs.
Got you. So you said you started this company 8 years ago?
Yeah, 8 years ago.
Can we go back further? Like, where are you from? Where'd you grow up? And kind of how did you end up here?
I mentioned I started this with Hal Hasuna. This is our second company together. And finding somebody you can work well with is incredible.
Yeah. I've talked to many people on this pod before about, like, you know, they've gone through, you know, founder dating and all of these things. And it's kind of, it sounds like it's a very, you know, it's almost like a marriage. It's, you know, it's a very tricky thing to get right and to find.
It is really tough. And you end up spending more of your wake hours with your partner than you do with your own, you know, spouse.
Yeah.
So listen, it's from that perspective, I think it's you know, it is important to get it right. But it is, you know, I've gone through it. It's hard to work with friends because you don't know what they're good at or not. You know, you're good friends with them. But if it's easier to become friends with people you work with. And it's been great working together. I say more that we work well is we know what each of us is good at and not good at, and we're right, okay with that, and we know how to resolve conflict easily. So I think those are the key things. But by way of background, I was actually born in Ethiopia. Born in Ethiopia, with five siblings. My mother was born in Ethiopia, my father in Tanzania.
My wife and I met in Dar es Salaam, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
Yes. Awesome. Yeah, totally randomly on a plane, we met actually as we landed into Dar es Salaam. Yeah, so that's cool.
My father's born in Dar es Salaam.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a special place in my heart there.
Yes.
But it's you know, I love Africa. It's an incredible place, but the people are just so nice and so warm. So when we spent there, I actually finished my high school in Dubai. We left because at the time there was a civil war going on in Ethiopia. We left and sort of eventually found ourselves in Dubai. This is for people that know of Dubai, this was not the Dubai that you can imagine.
Yes,
this was the desert.
Yes, totally. So you say your mom is from, were you in Addis Ababa or somewhere?
Yeah, so I was born in Addis. My mom was actually born in Dembidolo, which is in a different part, but ended up finishing school in Dubai and then came over to the US for university.
Got you. And your father is from Dar es Salaam, but your last name is D'Souza. I'm so confused right now.
It gets very complicated. You know, it's funny because I meet these people. Actually, when you speak to my children, people ask them where you're from. They go, how much time do you have? My father is actually part Indian, part Portuguese, but four generations are removed from Goa and India.
I see.
So they've been in Africa for a very long time. My mother is actually part Greek, part Ethiopian.
Wow. So you've got a little bit of everything.
Yes, I love the 23andMe because it just lights up the globe. I think in the family it's a funny one because nobody wants to marry, you know, nobody wants to marry their own. So everybody marries somebody new, saying it has got to be, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side. So
that's a steep hill to climb for you guys.
it's an interesting one from that perspective. But it gives you a very global outlook, which people talk about it, but you really get one of those. But also, I think having gone through countries where they've had strife in different ways, you know, people say, well, it's easy to be an entrepreneur coming from that. And I think sometimes people misconstrue that to say, oh, you have nothing to lose coming from Ethiopia. But I don't think it's a question of nothing to lose. Is you actually know what's important to you. Whenever there's strife, you realize that things can come and go. You may have it and you may not have it. And you can very quickly filter it down to things that are really important. And you go, and then I do have family, I do have friends, there are things that are important, and the rest are not that important to me. So it makes it much easier to do ventures and startups Because in the end, the things that are important, you won't lose, regardless of whether it goes well or not.
Right. And also just that willing, I mean, you're calling from Madrid, you used to live in San Francisco and, you know, for lots of reasons left, but it feels like most, just given your background, it's a muscle you've already flexed of just like, well, I'm going to go move somewhere else because this will be a better, you know, quality of life or makes more sense or whatever it may be. Most people won't make that move.
Yeah, is that right? The inertia is very hard versus, and I think part from my parents is the ability to say, let's do it. And my kids are scared to suggest things next to me because there's really a chance they say, let's do it. But I do. And I always remember reading this somewhere saying, in life, and as always, but especially early in life, it's important to say yes more than you say no.
Yes.
Because it's very easy to say no to things you don't know, you don't understand, and just say no. So what I do is surround yourself with people you trust, you care about, and all. And when they suggest something, say yes. And so I had a friend of mine, Jeff Stearns, he comes to me one day and he's talking about, what do you think about producing a movie? Now, I am not in the movie space at all.
Right.
But in the end, you know, why not? So we ended up jumping into it, doing it, and it'll be a lot of fun. You learn a lot. But you want people around that in your life. Is that when you come up with something slightly crazy, you know, you spend a few seconds thinking about it and going and playing with it, because you'll be surprised how many of those turn into... It may not be the initial idea, but some incarnation of that could be interesting. And if the people around you sort of kill it very quickly, then you have the wrong people around you.
Totally. So what was the movie?
Blood and Money.
Blood and Money. What was it about?
It's a thriller. It's an interesting of this person who's in the woods in Maine and finds a bag of money. And there's a filter of the money actually belongs to these criminals that spend the movie trying to go in.
I see. When did that happen? When did that come out?
This was 2 years ago.
Wow.
but I really do believe that it's when you get the situation of somebody saying, let's try something, it's definitely worth sort of pursuing and playing with it. And even if you don't end up doing just the process of thinking through it, it's worth it.
What was the most surprising thing about movie production? Or the kind of the best and the worst thing about that? Because it's such a, I have friends in that, vaguely in that industry, and it's just, you know, it's lots of highs and lows and lots of extremes.
But I have to say the full thing was a tremendous learning experience. But I'll say the most surprising thing is I'm shocked how many people still watch DVDs. I'm shocked. I just could not believe the numbers. I'm going, wait, you've got to be kidding me. And the full thing of how the distribution works was fascinating. To go through. So I know people keep saying that you always end up sort of losing money as you go through it and do it. It actually ended up doing really well. And full credit to full the team working on it, because they really understood what are the variables that you need to get right to get the full venture. Similar to other startups, there are a few things that matter a lot. You better focus on those.
Right. So if we go back, so you finished high school in Dubai and then moved to America.
Yeah, and we did not have much money at the time. So, you know, the good and the bad. The bad part is we didn't have money to pay for university. The good is that quickly relegated me to applying to universities that could give me full financial aid and scholarship, which means you're only applying to good universities. So it was a high risk. Either you get in to a good place and you get it, or you're not going.
Yeah.
So I did my undergrad, mixed it, part of it at UPenn and then at MIT. And it was a great experience. It was the first time I actually came into the U.S. I actually came in when I was 16. So I started university when I was 16. And all I knew about the U.S. is what we learned watching Dallas. So
did you show up with a 10-gallon hat and a big belt buckle?
It was quite a culture shock. It's funny because, you know, we probably shouldn't have been watching Dallas at that age, but you know, everybody watched it. And so I grew up watching all of Dallas, and that's all I knew about the U.S. And it was a huge sort of, everything was surprising.
Yeah, I bet. Are there any moments that stick out of like the culture shock of getting to America?
I'd say I was completely thrown in, because my roommate freshman year was an American football player. And I knew nothing about American football, zero. I'd never even watched it. But, you know, went from being, I'd say, pseudo-popular at school because I did well at academics to being completely, nobody cared about me in university because I knew nothing about American football. So that was an interesting culture shock, where it was just fascinating to me, where he got a lot of attention. You know, he'd come back with a slight injury and everybody would be there to feed him grapes or do this or that. And then I was saying, what about me?
But look at me. I'm really smart. I'm doing good stuff.
Yeah, it didn't get me very far.
No, I don't imagine. So after uni, what did you end up doing? And how did you say you started a company before. How did you get to the point where you started trying startups? Is that something from your parents, or is that just the kind of immigrant story of kind of hunger to try kind of to make it here? Or what kind of, how did that all come about?
You know, I think there are two. I feel starting a company is, in a lot of other countries, is not a huge hurdle.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of people trying businesses all the time. So I grew up in a culture where people would try it, and it could be by our neighbor. She was a Russian lady married to a Bengali husband, and she was trying to do a business, and she realized there was a business importing exporting electronics to Russia. And
right.
She didn't have anything in the background, went through. And so everybody tries it. You know, you go through it as you go. So I think the point of going through and starting something was not fun. I saw people trying small things, big things, every time. And my brother and I, there used to be a computer magazine called Computer and Video Games, CNVG. Okay. But this is when you were in high school. They had in the middle pages, they would always give you the listing, the actual code for a video game. It's probably like 1,000 lines or 2,000 lines. But right. My brother and I would actually type the full thing in, put it on cassettes, and sell it to other people who didn't want to type it in. So it was just a feeling of, wow. Once you type it in and debug right. all your errors, it was a feeling of what is it like to go and start a business. So
right.
I think that gave us a bit of it. And then after graduating, I did my undergrad grad. But after it, at MIT, we had this incredible experience. MIT launched this instant messaging service called Zephyr. And within 3 weeks, it was the number one application at MIT. Not only that, I think most people started failing out of MIT because they're spending all the time in instant messaging.
Yeah.
I think it killed. But on leaving university, I realized that, and together with my brother and a couple of friends from MIT, we realized that there was a need for instant messaging. And so that was the first company we started, and then sold that to Microsoft.
Oh, wow. When was that?
It was around 98.
Wow. So kind of the dawn of the web.
Yeah, this was right at the start, and it was clear at the time, having seen it, that it was a very different experience from email. And everybody goes, if you have email, why do you need it?
Right.
But you know, at the same time, it also shows you that there's a difference between companies that are made on new technologies, because there's a certain element of you need to understand what the problems are, because if you ask people, they don't know they need it.
Yeah.
And so this is a classic with instant messaging, same thing with battery swapping, where you can't start that sort of company saying, well, let me ask people if they think they need it. Because until they try it, you don't get a sense of whether you want it or not.
Right. It's kind of, if you build it, they will come kind of thing.
Exactly.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And so how old were you when you sold that first company?
About 26.
And was that like, hey, now I've made it, I'm rich, this is amazing, now what do I do with my life kind of thing.
Yeah, it was a phenomenal outcome.
What was the name of the company?
It was called Flash Communications. And our tagline was the speed of thought, which, you know, this is my interpretation. I think that in the end, Bill Gates bought it because he wanted to name his book that. because sure enough, his book is now called this, which I actually still think of today as a phenomenal tagline, speed of thought.
It is. That's actually, it's a good tagline. And so you sell that, and then what happens? Like, what do you do with your life?
it's funny. I think there is a big focus in many places on doing it for money and all that. And I can tell startups are the worst thing to do for money, because the probability of it succeeding is so low. So it's funny. You get all these people that the number one reason they do it is, oh, it's a great way. And look, there's so many easier ways to make money than doing a startup. So you better really enjoy it, because that might be all you're going to get out of a startup.
Yeah.
So the you know, if it works out, that's great, but that's not what happens to most. So it went from there. I did another startup after that called DSoft, which was doing online trading systems.
Yeah.
And that got acquired by Bank of America at the time and got rolled into Merrill Lynch. And it's their online trading platform.
I see.
And from there, I actually went to Goldman Sachs doing private equity. So I actually wanted to see the other side of it. So I'd done a startup new. And it is like everything else. The first time you do a startup, you make every mistake in the book. You know,
yeah.
You go through it, slowly get better at it, and it definitely gets easier as you go through it. But I ended up going from there to Goldman Sachs on the private equity side, to actually investing in companies in the private equity group out there. And it was a phenomenal experience. You get a chance to see it from the investor perspective, which when you're an entrepreneur, it's often hard to understand.
Yeah. When you were doing that job, was there like a thing that was like all of a sudden obvious to you as a founder of, like, you know, maybe you're frustrated because you were having trouble raising a fund, or your investors were acting a certain way, or just like, was there, you know, that dynamic, was there something that crystallized of like, oh, that's why this was so hard, or that's why this happened?
There definitely were. And actually, a simple one, and you know, this may not be true for most investors, but I realize why most investors won't tell you the truth about why they turn you down.
Why? Why is that?
You know, they all have a set of, you know,
kind of like your stock excuses.
Exactly. And when we tried to raise money right at the start for Ample, we got turned down by probably over 200 investors. So
yeah.
We at a certain point, we joke and try and guess into it which stock excuse they'd use to turn us down. But you'd always hear, oh, it doesn't fit our fund focus. We're, you know, we need to raise a new fund. And you raise in them, it's like everything else, that in the end, it's a pretty small startup world. And as an investor, even if you turn them down this round, you may want to be there for the next round. So nobody's going to actually tell you what they think. And I think the danger is when we started the first company, you actually believe them. And you try and modify your pitch to address what you're being told, until it took me later on to say, wait, they may not be telling you the truth. And so that was one of those aha moments. You go, wow, maybe I was just being naive. I didn't realize it. But I realized that they want to make sure they turn you down so that you still have a good relationship with them.
Right.
So that if you end up doing okay, they might come into it later on.
Well, it sounds like it's a little bit like, you know, if you're like breaking up with somebody and you don't want to be mean, so you make up some reason, and then they're like, well, I can fix that. I can change. And you're like, no, don't change. Just,
no, no, please, I just, no,
please. I'm just not that into you. I just don't want to say that.
Yeah, it's me, not you. It's me. You're exactly right. The only thing with the VCs is they may want to come around. It's just relationships that they usually are. But you are right, though. I did go through a bunch of those where I sat there, and that thing will. The full idea of getting references, it gave me a completely different perspective. I found out that entrepreneurs, if you ask another entrepreneur their reference, they're usually very honest. And I think there's this core of, you know, trust between entrepreneurs. I think I'll call them, I'll always tell them what I think. I cannot imagine myself not lying to another entrepreneur. They know how hard they're working for what they do. So that was an interesting one, versus I find those may not be true in other cases. And I've seen people give you a reference on a company that's that fault and ulterior motives. Yeah. And I realized that. So I think a lot of that, when I did my first company, I was very young. And so a lot of those dynamics, a lot more naive and trusting initially, until you go through it and sort of understand some of the dynamics and why people are doing, you know, what they're doing.
Right. So you did that for a while, and then I presume you jumped back into the startup world at some point?
Exactly. I went back in, and that's with my current co-founder, Harlan. We started a company in the health space, and we went through and we started a company that was to go through and give people the tools to monitor and manage their own health. We realized at the time that at a macro perspective, what was happening in the healthcare industry is that people were living longer, had more health issues. They needed more healthcare.
Yeah.
The healthcare system had a shortage of doctors. They were unable to go through and deliver it. And whatever help you got costs you way too much. And that was a vicious cycle that we said, until you can get people to get more involved in their own health, this is going to break. So we created a platform to allow people to go and connect with others, collect health data, view the data based on the condition they have. And then, you know, we ended up with over 20 million people actively using the platform. And then that got acquired by Merck Pharmaceuticals.
Wow. Okay. So you've started and sold three companies at this point.
Yep.
And does that bring you to Ample?
Yes.
And so it was messaging, finance, medicine, and now electric cars. Why'd you go there?
And I will be honest, Harold and I think then we wanted to work together. Just whether it's like we enjoyed working together, definitely wanted to start another company. And we looked at a few different things. But this full energy transition was just, whenever you see a massive change in a big industry, there's a lot of opportunity.
Yeah.
And so we said, if you're trying to move one third of human energy consumption from one form to the other, there's going to be a lot of opportunity out there.
Yeah.
We looked at the different things, and very quickly we realized that the part that was broken and nobody was working on was charging.
Right.
And so we said, if there's a way to solve that problem, there's a huge opportunity. And then we literally sort of had to go and spend the first few years solving a lot of the technical problems to create a solution that could work across different cars and allow a car to work with any battery and put new batteries. There are a lot of technical challenges out there. So we spent the first few years solving that. Once we solved it and realized it was technically possible, at that point we went down and raised the first round of funding.
So obviously you've done really well in terms of the previous companies you've sold, but the tech you're trying to solve is not easy or cheap, and it involves hardware, which is expensive. So were you basically just doing that on your own? Because I was looking at your the video on the website before of like what Ample looks like, and it kind of looks like a garage. You drive in and then like they kind of come up from underneath, take out the battery, and then put a new one in. That's basically how it works, correct?
Exactly.
But did you basically figure that out and make a prototype on your own before you went and raised money? Or was it just like, okay, this is generally the idea, this is how it's going to work, these are why the economics work, etc.?
No, we funded it for the first few years on our own. I'd say we raised the round of funding, we had a working prototype, we'd solved all the problems. So there was a few years into it, 3 or 4 years into it. And it was a combination. One is, you know, we had to do a certain amount of that work to get there. The other part was what I was starting to do in that we got turned down a lot.
Yeah.
I think one thing that you hear a lot of VCs that talk about investing in cutting technologies or, yeah, you know, deep tech. Very few of them do deep tech. You know, deep tech is a new version of Uber.
Yep.
So it was surprising because we'd read the pitches that they had and assume that this would be a perfect fit. In fact, one VC from a deep tech VC actually came and told us, look, I love you guys. I'll give you $20 million, but why don't you just do anything in software? It doesn't matter to me what you do. You know, AI stuff.
Well, because software is easy, right? Because you write the code and the incremental cost of the next customer is effectively zero and it scales really easily. And it's bytes, not atoms. The Silicon Valley likes bytes, not atoms.
And in the end, I have to say, and I'll give a lot of credit to a couple of the investors in the first round, both Shell Ventures and More Capital. Everybody said there are a lot of VCs that spend a lot of time thinking about the 100 reasons why the company could fail. And there are probably 1,000 reasons the company could fail. But the ones that actually invest are the ones that look, what if things go right? And I think that's the mindset that was different. And they spend a lot of time saying, if this works, this could change a full industry.
Right.
And they got very interested. And I'd also say we did try. Most VCs funds out there, the hard fund ones, we didn't try. But we actually got investment from Amy Gu. And as I mentioned her, it was the only VC, it was Hemi Ventures, that we actually sent an email to, a cold email, and actually led to an investment.
Oh, really?
Because I actually think most VCs probably don't even monitor that email.
Yeah,
it probably
yeah,
goes totally. Straight to spam. So I actually mentioned Amy because that was it's the only one in my entire experience where you send a cold email actually resulted in an investment.
Right. And so your first investors were Shell and More Capital, the hedge fund?
Correct. They have a venture arm.
I see.
And so it came from the venture arm.
Got you. And so you built a prototype. Was it like basically a kind of a retrofitted Jiffy Lube in San Francisco?
You know, anybody who's gone through and done the full thing with demos and startups, I think will really, really understand the, you know, how finicky those things would be. So, you know, the first one we were using, we created a prototype, and it happened to be that we couldn't do our demos between, I think, 2 and 3 in the afternoon. And that's because the light would come in through this, through a skylight and wreak havoc on our senses.
Right.
But, you know, we our initial one was a garage. It was actually a former taco factory, which was actually perfect for us because you'd bring vehicles in. It was built in and out, got the first prototypes up and running. We were able to go and demonstrate it working. And it was very impressive because you take literally... We took on our first vehicle radio control batteries, and we could get a car to work on it because the full idea of separating the car from the chemistry is a part of our key patent and the key technology we went through and solved. So it was very impressive that you literally put any cars in any battery or any batteries in any car and get it to work. So the demo, and then we had the full swapping going as well.
So when did you actually bring in that first round of cash?
I think it was around, I may get it wrong, but around 2017 or 18.
Got you. And so now the challenge, right, is to kind of scale it up and I presume bring along the OEMs to go back where we started of getting them to buy into this idea of, like, you know, basically sell cars with no batteries or swappable batteries, which even on fleets, that feels like a big ask. But maybe the problem you are solving is the solution is effective enough for them to kind of agree.
I think this is exactly it. Is in the end, it's the fleets that end up persuading the OEMs.
Right.
Because if it's hard to find fleets that have deployed electric at scale and got it to work. They run into too many issues with the charging infrastructure. They don't have the power. It costs them too much time. It takes too long to deploy it. Or the operational complexity is too high. So I think for us, the biggest salespeople are the fleets because they understand the need. They want it. And when they go to an OEM and they say, we're interested in buying a few thousand vehicles, but we want to be swappable. The OEMs, you know, are interested in working with them, saying how we go through. So that, I think, has happened. The other thing that's happened has really helped us is two things. One is China has sort of made a massive pivot to swapping.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they realize, and 82% of the world's fast chargers are in China. So they have the largest, you know, fast charging infrastructure in the world. And I think they realize that this is not going to scale. They're not going to move this.
Right.
And so right now, almost every OEM in China has a swapping solution that goes. You have massive fleets in China that are going through and using swapping as the primary means. And so I think people can look there and see here's a good demonstration of it working at scale. And I say outside of China, you also have other countries like India going through and saying they want to do swapping. So other countries are going through. But also people have seen that it worked really well with 2 and 3 wheelers. So, you know, if you look at electric motorbikes, swapping works incredibly well.
Right.
So I think people have seen the success it's had in those and saying it's a natural way to go through and do it. How do we expand it to other forms?
I understand from my perspective as a user, if I can go in and 10 minutes later, you go from, like, you know, 10 miles left of my battery to 300 miles. That makes total sense. But you still would need, I presume, a massive charging infrastructure to charge up all the replacement batteries all the time, no?
Yeah, that's what the problem with charging is. Suppose you have a 100 kilowatt connection into a charger.
Yep.
Then you're only using it when somebody's plugged in. The rest of the time, it's doing absolutely nothing. So if you move to swapping, it's continuously charging batteries 24/7.
Right.
And so that's what. The second thing is, speaking of, well, what happens if you have high utilization on a charger? The problem with a charger is that once you get to high utilization, the wait time becomes untenable, even at around 30%. If you have 30% utilization on a charger, you could be waiting 30 to 40 minutes before you start charging.
Mm.
So you can't get to high utilization on a charger unless it's fully programmatic and you know exactly when you start and stop. So in the end, I think 30% is very generous. Usually chargers end up with like 20% utilization. And so 80% of time is doing nothing. That 80% at a swapping station is charging batteries, which means you can swap a lot more
cars. Right. In terms of that, where have you got, because I know you guys have raised a bunch of money in the last 9 months. I think it's, now you've raised something like $260 million total, is that right?
Correct.
Where have you got to in terms of adoption, getting OEM signed up, getting partners? Just give, if you could give a sense of kind of the progress you're making there, because it, as you say, it's a huge transition and there's a lot of heavy lifting involved. How far have you got?
We are commercial in the Bay Area. So if you take Uber vehicles there, there's a chance you may be in a swappable vehicle out there. So we do have right now, we have about 10 stations deployed across where the drivers can go in and swap. We're going to be deploying in Europe later this year as well. And then after that, we'll actually be deploying in Japan as well. So I think from a deployment perspective, we've gone through the deployment process for a single station is pretty quick. We can get it done in a couple of weeks.
Right.
There's no construction involved, which makes it very easy. From an OEM perspective, we have 5 OEM partners that we work with. We still have NDAs with them and can't go and mention them. We will start mentioning them very soon. But they're some of the largest OEMs in the world.
Right.
So I think from that perspective, they have realized that in order to go through and sell vehicles, I'd say there's one part that works really well right now is where people buy a vehicle, they have a garage, and they probably have a second car that's gas as well.
Yep.
If you have that, it works. But if you have a single vehicle and if you don't have a garage, it starts falling apart very quickly.
Yep.
And then for fleets, it's really tough. You know, as soon as you go to more than 20 cars, it falls. So for us, that's what the OEMs are looking at and saying, if you look at the projections where these countries want to go in terms of number of vehicles by 2030, they need a better solution for the infrastructure, and that's where swapping fits really nicely.
And is that, from where you sit, is that the kind of general realization? And I ask because we're at this really interesting moment where, you know, you've had GM, VW, Ford, all these companies say, we're going full electric, right? Like the internal combustion engine is going to be dead within 10, 15 years. This shift is happening and it's happening pretty quickly. And you have a ton of new makes and models coming out over the next 18 months, especially in America. As you know, like there's a whole bunch of pickup trucks. And if you electrify pickup trucks, you electrify America. So that's all really interesting. But is there this realization broadly that to make this work at that level, you need swapping? Or is it just you need a ton of fast chargers, because that's, you know, Tesla obviously has built a huge supercharger network. Rivian is trying to build its own, etc. You have companies that are setting up their charging infrastructure, but it's just, what is your sense of kind of inside the industry as we look forward in the next 5, 7, 8, 10 years, what that looks like?
So I think the realization is definitely set in, because initially many car companies said most people charge at home.
Yeah.
You realize that most people cannot charge at home. You know, that doesn't work for majority of people. They park on the street, they're in condo buildings without. So majority, probably 70% plus, cannot charge at home. So, you know, how do you go through and solve it? The full idea of building lots of fast chargers is just not a scalable solution. Fast chargers work well as a supplemental charging system.
Yeah.
Where you need, you know, 5% of your miles now and then on a highway, you can use it. If you need to get 100% of your miles, fast charging doesn't work at all.
No.
It's too expensive, takes too long to try and build them in cities. Very few cities are even contemplating putting them within it. And it takes too long. It's okay when it's supplemental, but if every time you need to charge it, you have to go and spend 45 minutes, it's going to break down very quickly. So I think that realization has come in, is that one is people going to charge at home is a myth. Second is the infrastructure will take care of itself. It's not happening.
Yeah.
And also, in the end, we're doing this to go green. And in order to go green, having people lease cars for 3 years, fast charge it for 3 years and then get rid of the car. It's much worse than going with gas. If you got a gas car and kept it for 15 years, it'd be much better than doing that. So in order to achieve the convenience that people need, the green outcomes that they want, and actually come up with something that can be deployed fast and scaled, they also need to look at alternative solutions to charging.
And on that green point, are you guys doing any deals with kind of renewable generators or kind of working around ensuring that, because the cynics will say, well, basically you've just swapped out a petrol car for a coal powered car, because that's where so much of the electricity comes from. But what does that kind of look like for you guys?
We are in different ways in different cities. Some cities, you know, what time of the day you get more renewable and you can optimize it to charge it. Then in some cities, you can go through and sign contracts for renewable. But in places where you can actually connect to renewable, because our batteries in the swap stations act like buffers or storage to the grids, it's a great place to store renewable energy. So our swapping stations end up being the solution of how do you marry renewable energy, which is unpredictable supply, with electric cars, which is unpredictable demand. So you then to connect those, you need a buffer, which is batteries, and we are a natural buffering mechanism to connect those two.
Got you. So in your vision of the future, there will be, you're starting with fleets, obviously, but you think the ultimate picture will be that a lot of the big brands that we all know, big car brands, will offer this as an option of, you know, swappable batteries, especially as we get deeper into this transition.
Exactly. I think you'll see a lot, just exactly as you've seen it happen in China, that a lot of people start going through moving that model. And I think from a personal perspective, would you pay a lot more, 30, 40% more to a vehicle to own the battery, knowing that that battery is going to go bad and it's going to be very hard to change? So I think it's going to be a natural one where people realize that I would rather pay significantly less for this vehicle and have also the potential to keep the car for longer, but also put in newer technologies. Newer chemistries so my car can go further. So I think it'll be a natural one. There'll continue to be a few people that want to own it, and that makes sense if you want to charge it at home. But for everybody else, you know, swapping would be a great alternative.
Got you. And then just finally, do you have any of your kind of stations in London or Britain?
Not yet. So that's high on our list to get out there. I think London has done a great job in terms of incentivizing. Although I heard recently that they may have just cancelled the incentives, but they've done a good job. And when you go there, you see a lot of electric vehicles deployed out there. So I think it's a place we'd love to go, and we're starting to do the work there. They don't have the grid to support fast chargers in the city. So swapping would be a natural way for them to go through and do it. Even though you can't get a lot of real estate, there's a lot of parking. And for us, if you have two parking spaces, we can deploy a station. So we can actually find the city within, places within the city to go through and deploy it.
Got you. So it's two parking spaces. If everything is working fabulously, how many cars can be charged, quote unquote, in a day, or I don't know, in 12 hours or something, relative to say a supercharger or one of these other spots?
You know, if you have enough power coming in, you can do 10 to 12,000 an hour. So you can go through a lot. You can easily do over 100 cars in 12 hours.
Right.
But if you look at superchargers, depending on how long you want people to wait, realistically, most superchargers have under a 20% utilization or fast chargers in general. So if you look at a 10-hour period, you'll be lucky for 2 hours that they're going through and charging. At over 2 hours, maybe they've gone through and charged four cars.
Right.
So it's a huge difference in between charging four, or using that and charging 100.
Right. And then just lastly, you have a deal with Uber, is that right?
Yeah, so Uber's been a great partner. We've been working with them for a while. They have a commitment to go through and convert their fleet to electric. And so it's been a natural use case. You have a high utilization use case where people are driving a large number of miles. This is their livelihood. So these are not people who spend 12 to 14 hours a week at a charger. So it is a direct impact on the amount of money they earn. And if you convert it, it also has a huge green benefit because these are lots of miles being driven. Right. So I think it's helping them in that conversion to electric sort of benefits a lot of people.
Right. Well, it sounds like you have your work cut out, but it's also very exciting.
Thank you. It's great to be in the space right now. When we started, you know, lots of people were looking at electric and saying Android was going to happen. You know, yeah. They're very skeptical. It's the stage right now is it's happening. We just need to solve the problem. So it's really exciting to be in the space right now.
Yeah. Well, I will leave you to your Friday in Madrid. I hope you go have some jamón serrano and some fabulous Rioja and enjoy the sun.
Thank you very much. It's great to be chatting with you.
And that is all the time we have. I want to thank John for taking the time all the way calling in from lovely Madrid. I want to thank you all for listening, for rating, for reviewing, for sharing the word, spreading the word, sharing the word. You know what I mean. Thank you again for listening. I'll be writing about... I might be writing about more crypto stuff this weekend. It's just kind of the story, the big, big story that's kind of taken up a lot of my time at the moment. So do check that out in thetimes.co.uk. Pick up the paper. Follow me on Twitter at Danny Fortson. Email me at danny.fortson@sunday-times.co.uk. And that is it for me this week. Have a fabulous, fabulous weekend, and we'll talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.